fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
On 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and
1050
AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren. I got Mr. Dave Martino here, and usually means it's going to be a rough day.
Of course.
Well, you know.
I'm here to torment you, Al.
You are. I think that's the only reason you're here. You're here just to make things tougher.
That's right.
It's not going to be easy.
Like walking uphill.
Yeah. Oh, I haven't done that in 30 years.
No.
You know, I can't.
Good for your dogs?
No. I take the flat route. You know, but he's 19. How am I going to?
Oh, that's true.
If I give him too much of a hill, he'll just he'll collapse on me, and I'll collapse, and nobody will come get us for days. You know, it's strange. Are you buying stuff off Facebook? Have you ever bought something off Facebook?
I have not. No.
I see a woman here in California. Well, of course, she bought some hemorrhoid ointment.
Really?
On Facebook.
On Marketplace? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm just on Facebook. I don't know if it's Marketplace or Facebook. No, but anyway, she died.
Oh.
Lead poisoning. It had 4% lead in it. I couldn't imagine. I mean, you know, I don't know. I just thought I'd mention that because I know that you're kind of, you know, you stay at home alone, sitting in the basement.
Yeah. Ordering stuff off of Facebook.
Yeah. And just, you hang out and wait for stuff. You know, not saying you have hemorrhoids, but...
No. But, I'll make sure that that's the cream I don't get.
Yeah, that's with two T's. Yeah, so stay away from it because it's got a lot of lead.
Speaking of lead,
or butts, or hemorrhoids, I don't know. What a segue. We've got a writer, actor, dancer. He does it all. So anyway, he's got a new book coming out, or it might be out. We'll find out. And it's called The War Machine, Barry W. Beebe. So thank you for being here, Barry.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Surprised you're still here. Usually after our intros, people run away.
That's the hemorrhoid cream story, yes.
Yeah. Well, there you go. So stay away from that. Don't be buying hemorrhoid stuff off of...
Writers, hemorrhoids, they might go hand in hand. I don't know.
Oh, hand.
Lots of
hand
sitting.
Lots of sitting. Yeah, see, that happens. You know? So listen, you were doing all sorts of stuff. You're like a filmmaker, actor, and all this stuff. So why would you... do that, like why would you take that and be a writer?
That's a really good question. Well, it the whole genesis of this story was I'd been acting for about, I don't know, 10 or 11 or 12 years, and I, you know, like all actors, I didn't think I was getting the parts I really wanted, so I wrote one for myself, and then I foolishly raised money and then shot it as a low-budget independent film. I say foolishly because most people will start with a short and then, you know, sort of get the hang of it. But I, you know, I like to fail a little bit upward. So it was a long process, but we got it done. It's still up on Amazon.com. It's called Spook. It is based on the true story of this guy that I met in, of all places, a smoke-filled bingo hall in East Vancouver, Canada.
Wow. And East Van, that's not pretty.
Well, it's getting, it's got its own charm. I'll put it that way. I like there's a place on there called Commercial Drive, which is really quite funky. And that's,
Commercial Drive, but that's the lesbian part of town.
Yes, it swings many ways. Yes.
I know this because I lived in Vancouver a long time.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a Canadian. I'm like you. I've got both.
Yeah.
So I'm a Canuck as well. So
well done. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. I know. Well done. And I've got my place in Canada for escape for the next election. I'm ready.
Yeah.
You got to be ready. Always be on edge.
Yes. You always have to have a good back door to somewhere.
Oh yeah. I like a good back door.
I was waiting for that.
But that's a different story. That's a different. It's not about me here. So the War Machine. Why the War Machine? Why write that kind of a story?
Well, I guess the short answer is in today's climate is it's about a lot of things, but it's mostly about power and the abuse of power and the way, you know, absolute power and people who want that sort of thing tend to creep up on us. Democracy is incredibly fragile and it's under attack. And it's one of those times, the time that I'm writing about in around 19 during the Vietnam War was a time in Canada where the dish was starting to run away with the spoon, so to speak. The Canadian government was doing whatever it wanted, and no one was really pressing them. And the citizens of Canada just kind of either turned a blind eye or didn't know or didn't want to know what Canada was doing during the Vietnam War. They thought that basically we're out there trying to negotiate peace and putting up hospitals and treating people, and at the same time not knowing that we were treating people in these hospitals with the munitions that we made in the first place.
And we had sorry printed on the bullets.
Yeah, exactly. not sorry, but sorry.
Sorry. And listen, so why take this point of view in the sense of, because you got a, you know, if I remember the premise here, you've got a Canadian-born American mainstone killer is kind of how you say it. And so Canada was kind of avoiding the Vietnam War, right? A lot of people in Canada didn't take part in it. Like it wasn't a national thing, right?
Yeah, it was actually illegal for Canadians to go and fight in the war. There was some sort of arcane law that was still in the books. 3,000 Canadians asked for official permission from the government to go fight and were allowed, but another between 30 and 40,000 Canadians basically just walked across the border and said, I want to volunteer to fight. In some cases, if they went to the Marines, the Marine Corps would say, no, but not us, but go down the hall to the Army, they'll take anyone. and they did. They would generate a Social Security number for them, send them to basic training. Their address would be general delivery, what, you know, border town they happened to walk into. In the case of my guy, it was Blaine, Washington. That was his official address. So, and then he went to basic training. And because they figured that most of Canada speaks French, which is not actually the case, I mean, about 15-20% probably do, they sent a lot of these guys directly to special forces because Vietnam was a former French colony. And they thought, well, they'll be able to get along with the locals a lot better. They'll speak, you know, one of the languages at least. And that's how a lot of them ended up in special forces. And in this case, with my guy, MacVie Sogg, which was the absolutely double secret probation, top secret special forces operation that operated over the fence during the Vietnam War.
You must have done a lot of research to kind of get into all the details of this.
There's been a ton, yeah. I did. I wrote this originally as a play. And then, you know, I think that was the last play I produced because you soon realize, well, that's gone. And, you know, there's about 1,000 people who come up after you and say, like, oh, you're going to do it again? I missed it. Sorry. And no, we're not doing it again. We lost enough money. So, you know, I adapted it to an independent feature. There's nothing like a book. And during COVID, I had a lot of time during lockdown to write a book, basically. I just set myself up to write a good 5 pages a day, and that's what I did until the book was done.
You didn't go on the truck rally or anything, hey? You
just... I did not go on the truck rally.
Oh, wow. How do you get into the mindset? Like, the main character in this, where did you get that character from, and what's your working experience with that character?
Oh, yeah, that was a process. So the guy's name, I don't know his real name to this day. I don't know where he is at this point. He may have passed away while I was out of the country for several years. I can't find him, but, I mean, he was always the kind of guy that, you know, he was only found when he wanted to be found. But I met him, you know, during a failed bingo fundraiser for the now closed theater company that I had. And we went out to drown our sorrows because we had lost money on a fundraiser, was a fund loser. And one of his buddies was there and who said, did Dale tell you he fought in Vietnam? And then I said, well, how could you? You're Canadian, aren't you? He said, yeah. Well, how could you do that? Well, I just went across the border and volunteered. So, well, that's not possible. He said, well, I can assure you it was. And that's what I did. And as he told me more and more, you know, as I continued to buy him lunches and lots of beer, he basically told me his entire life story. You know, the story of, like, you know, some sweet kid from British Columbia who, you know, just goes off to find his own military experience like his father had found in the Second World War, started becoming a story that just turned into a, like, a long waking nightmare. And before I tell you this next part about my own PTSD, I should say that, you know, don't shed a tear for me. I'm a white guy from a wealthy-ish part of southern Ontario, Canada, who had access to excellent counseling, and I've been well looked after with my PTSD, and I won't even go into it. But his PTSD, I could not even imagine. But it was that sort of, like, experience of trauma that led him to trust me to tell me about some of the things that happened to him. And I touched on a few of them in the book, but there's still lots more. He went all the way over the line, and then he just kept going. You know, it was like, you know, the story of Achilles after he loses his friend, and he just goes berserk. I mean, this man was a killer's killer. He became so well known in Vietnam that they had to find a way to sort of, you know, disappear him somehow because the bounty on his head was so high.
Well, as you took on his experiences, listening to his story, and then translating it into the character in the book, did you use your acting experience to create this character? I know some writers have told us that for them, writing their characters is sort of like method acting.
Yeah, definitely. And for him, absolutely. And for pretty much everything I write, I always have someone in mind. Someone that I either know reasonably well or, you know, I might think I know reasonably well. And I find that really helpful because it makes your characters distinctive and you get a sense. I thought I was crazy when this started happening when I was writing, but I structure, you know, pretty severely. But then once I've set the structure through an outline, I sort of step into it. I know what scene I'm going to write, but then I just try to let the characters talk and write down what happens. And I am constantly surprised by what happens to the point where that structure often changes as I go through the writing process, whether it's a screenplay or a book. And it certainly happened in this book. This went, this went places that I wasn't fully expecting it to go, honestly.
Well, do you hear your characters? Do you have an inner monologue? It sounds like you were listening to them. Is that how you create the characters, create the prose, create the dialogue? Or do you have a different way of doing it?
It's you know, if they were real people, it would be some sort of a partnership. So I know how by setting some sort of persona for them, they are now restricted by how they can speak. So they have to speak in the vernacular and in the way that particular person that I know or that I imagine would speak. They will also criticize each other in the way that, you know, two people who don't get along will criticize each other. So, yeah, it's kind of like a running improv between myself and the characters in the scene. So you can see why I thought I was crazy.
I was going to say, and they let you drive? Just like, you know. Don't let people know this. They won't let you across the border again. So when you write a book like this, and you're kind of into this and all the deep story and involved and stuff in the history, is there some sort of a subtext? Is there some sort of a meaning that you want people to get out of this?
Yeah, well, there's always, yeah. I learned the hard way that you do need to structure and you do need at least a main theme. Quite often you won't know that main theme until the end of the book. But I think in this particular book, it's like you've got to get to know your demons and learn how to dance with them, or they will consume you. And that is the main journey of this character. Because when we meet him at the beginning, there's a flashback scene to Vietnam in the very first chapter. But the second chapter, we're meeting him 20 years later. When he is pretty much at the end of his rope, and he's got one more thing holding them together, and that is to find a way to get all the information that he's managed to collect about Canada's involvement in the Vietnam War and somehow get it published somewhere, a newspaper, a magazine, a book. But he's such a wreck at this point that there's no possible way he could do it by himself. And that's a great circumstance for a main character, to be painted straight into a corner, and to give a character who doesn't want to reach out, who is a lone wolf, to have to rely on being a partner with somebody else. And that's how we start the tale.
When you get this involved in a character and you have a lot of things that you relate to him with, and you go over the whole, you know, all the scenarios, all the crime and violence that he had to deal with in the war and stuff, how do you think this book has changed you?
A number of ways. When I started this story originally, before it was a book, I came at it from a very anti-war point of view. And as I dug deeper and read more and investigated more, I read a lot of other people's books who were written on more historical-based books, I realized that the Vietnam War did actually serve a very important purpose. And the clincher to this was the gentleman who shot my low-budget independent movie is from Malaysia. And he said when he moved to Canada, he was surprised to hear that people in North America think that America lost the war. Because where he grew up in Malaysia, they considered the war a success. Because they say it stopped communism, so people in Malaysia didn't have to fight it there. And I thought that was fascinating, and that spun my head around. So from that point of view, that was a shift, and it led me to write a more balanced story. I'm not pro or anti-war, but I mean, sometimes you got to go to war and you got to kick butt. And if you're going to go, you need to go hard and you need to go all the way. But you want that to be the very last option. Personally, how it adjusted me was I realized, you know, I had thought I had dealt with my demons sufficiently, and it became pretty clear that I hadn't. So I ended up, when I was living in Los Angeles, I mean, what a better place to find a shrink than L.A. I mean, they deal with more crazy than anyone on the planet. So I managed to find myself an excellent counselor, and we got into it deeper. And that was, and that seemed, for the most part, at least for the time being, to have done the trick. But PTSD is a gift that keeps on giving, and you have to stay ahead of it.
Right. Is that before or after you started murdering people?
I have actually never, I mean, I have fired guns, and I am certified to carry, to own one in California, but I don't own one. I've never shot anyone. I've never murdered anyone, of course. I mean, I was a pretty scrappy kid, but otherwise, you know, and I almost got my orange belt in karate twice, but otherwise, I'm a pretty mellow dude.
Well, do you, speaking of that, do you worry about getting military equipment and firearms, right? Because I know a lot of people who read the genre are very particular, and as soon as they see something that they deem a mistake, they're emailing and they're right
oh,
on
I know.
You.
I know. But I'm fortunate because the publishers of this book, The War Machine, their company's called Double Dagger Books. They are ex-Canadian military and ex-security experts. So I think one is still working in the field at this point. So they know what they're talking about. And I asked them about did I get it right? And they said, you got it right enough. But they also said that most people with their backgrounds tend not to watch war movies because so many things are wrong. I also had a Canadian historian at the University of Calgary go over it and, like, catch a couple of things. That would not have been a blah-blah helicopter because that would be too noisy. Oh, okay. And the CIA would have used this one. So I did get it vetted by a number of people, but I know, I mean, you can try your hardest, but there will still be a typo in your book, and there'll still be some sort of mistake where they wouldn't have sent a Huey, they would have sent a Jolly Green Giant. But, I mean, I did my absolute best, and I got it checked as best I could, but I'm sure someone's going to find something in there that's inaccurate. But
well, we'll hope that they do. We'll make sure. And we'll give them all your information so they can
thank you so much.
We want to make sure you know. Well, are you thinking about how much and how you write violence through the book as well in these times?
Yeah. And I got to tell you, too, there were some dark days writing some of this stuff. But I'm hoping it's more cathartic for people, because I think my wife is a big fan of horror movies and that whole genre. But she won't watch anything that is based on reality. I'm hoping that people who read this genre also get a sort of cathartic experience, to the point where, because it's nicely resolved, I'll let you know that about the book, that, you know, reading a book like this is enough. But I mean, there's an atmosphere in both Canada and the U.S. right now where it's a little volatile, and it does cross my mind. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's crazy.
I know.
You know, when you were going through this guy's stories and history and the things that someone goes through in war, how did you select and put together which stories you were going to tell, like how you were going to tell it? Do you know what I mean? Like how could you, there's probably things he told you that you didn't want to use too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There's one in particular where, he was in hand to hand with some guy and it's got a gruesome end. I might save that for the next book. The loss of his friends, I could tell, was always the thing that bothered him the most. And the loss of any good friends. You could feel the sadness pouring off of him when he talked about that stuff. He went through a lot. Holy smokes. I mean, and he's just a little guy, like 5'7", 5'8" at the most. You would not think to look at this guy that this is the war machine that they would drop out of a helicopter from 500 feet, to go hunt someone down on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. But he was. And, but he said he had no regrets. I mean, he went to find his war and he found it. And he eventually made his way back, to be with society. He was very gregarious, when I knew him at that point. But it had been some, 25 years since he came back from the war, and he went off and was a mercenary after that as well. So it was tough sitting with him sometimes when he was telling these stories. But I treasure them too, because he really trusted me. He trusted me a lot, and that was very touching.
Did you tell him your horror stories too, and then you compared notes?
Well, yeah, it was. I mean, that's the thing. That's the thing about PTSD, too, is that everyone's worst experience is a 10 out of 10. So my 10 out of 10 is nothing. I mean, his 10 out of 10s were like unbelievable, just unbelievable stories. And he was not alone. I mean, there's a guy named John Stryker Meyer who has a podcast called SOGcast, S-O-G, cast. And it is all veterans that survived MACV SOG, and in some cases, people who were in the Phoenix Project as well. And they are telling their own stories to another veteran because that's probably the only way they would ever tell them. And it is riveting, riveting. And that was one of my double checks on everything that I wrote too, was did I get it right from the point, like if one of these guys read this book, would be okay with it. And, I made some adjustments based on that, because all this stuff was top secret for 20 years. None of them talked. None of them said a word. And then all of a sudden the information started trickling out. But some of the stories on that podcast are just like, oh my goodness.
Yeah. How would you get the, cause you have your main character. How do you get the points of view of the other characters in the book too, as well, like how they were feeling? Do you know what I mean? Because he's telling you a story of what he went through, mm-hmm. and how he did something. You know, was in a battle or in some sort of event, and then you're getting his story. He's telling you it, but the people that he was with at that time, I wonder, or even maybe killed or was up mm-hmm. against. How do you kind of get their feel as well? Do you think?
Yeah, so there is one particular scene where they're trying to get the hell out of Dodge, basically, and they're being pursued, and I flip the lens, and I talk about the two Viet Cong soldiers that are pursuing him, their names, how they were led, how they got to the point where they volunteered to fight with Ho Chi Minh, and then, you know, their final moments. And I, because I don't think it would have been balanced enough to tell the story without some of those. There's also another scene earlier on where he's in an urban setting in the time that it's written in 1988, where I flip the lens again to cover the person who's trying to assassinate him. And, yeah, it's, well, you know, when you're writing that stuff, I gotta be honest, it's disturbing, but it gives you a chance to be there without having to be there. And, yeah, there were a couple of stories he told me when he was like, you know, an enemy combatant was literally, they were breathing in each other's faces trying to kill each other. And, man, that's some big trauma, man. That's some big stuff.
Well, speaking of that, how do you choreograph your action scenes? Do you act them out? Do you have a certain structure? How do you go about doing that?
I think for the most part, and this is all the kind of the stuff that I find a bit tedious. So I write it through once with just the bare bones, and then I go back and I start placing obstacles, and then I leave it for a bit and I go back, and then I try to work in, you know, a bit more character and what people are thinking and what they're doing, or if they're thinking, or whether they're just on, you know, full auto. And then I leave it. But the key for me is to, like in the old days of Hollywood, they would do a first cut on a movie and then they let it sit for a month and then they go back and look at it. I like to leave things for as long as it takes and then come back and look at it again. And, oh, that's crap. Get rid of it. Or, oh, that's a golden moment. And things will, your subconscious will work for you, and they'll just spring to your mind. Then you can't be afraid of writing a chapter that's got a big, soft, crappy part in the middle of it. You just have to know that you got to get through that part and then come back to it and fix it later. I wish I was the kind of writer who could write it all in one take, but I simply can't. I have to go back and forth a lot. But it is, you know, tedious to talk about, you know, you got to get in, all the guns are nicely researched, I think, and then you got to put in that research, and then you got to pare it down so it's not like tedious and boring. And it just takes a while to distill all of these action moments down to the part where they're interesting but not tedious, and they move forward but not too fast. The people miss things. It's just one of those things you've got to grind through, and it's not my favorite part. It's my favorite part when I read it back and I've got it right, but it just takes time. As someone told me once, there's no substitute for time.
Do you have kind of like a series Bible, or a kind of a Bible for the story itself, to make sure that everything, you know, you make sure the you know, if a character has blue eyes, they remain blue throughout the
yeah, I do a character breakdown of every character as well. So names, someone, I forget when I was writing this, they suggested make sure all of your names start with a different letter, because people will get confused if there's six people whose names all start with the letter D. So that's
right.
So I made a list of all that, you know. In a lot of cases, I had to go back and, like, what was the day? You know, when was he born? When were his parents born? When would his friend have been born? So I detail all of that backstory stuff as I'm going, as best I can. Sometimes I have to change it later just to make sure that, you know, I don't get my dates wrong. I don't get an age wrong, and that sort of thing. Because when I read, I mean, he did it to an extreme amount, but Michener, when he wrote those historical novels of his, those giant books, doorstops, man, the detail in that was so good and so fascinating, but sometimes it was just too much. I try and get all that stuff in there and make sure that I'm not repeating myself, repeating a character, or have too many characters that are the same. And as my wife will tell me, it's boring when it's just a bunch of dudes. So put some women in there and make them interesting, but not in the, you know, historical sense of the way women are made to be interesting. And the way I do that is I just write them as a person. And if they're, if they're girly or masculine, I just kind of don't think about that. I just write them as, you know, someone I would know who was like this or like that. And I sort of leave gender out of it for a while until my wife does a proofread, and then she'll let me know if I've, you know, messed up.
We were talking about editing and kind of paring things down. Do you find that the hardest part of writing? What's the hardest part for you when you're going through a going through your manuscript and getting it ready?
Yeah, throwing out your babies is tough. it's tough. Or kill your darlings, as many people put it. Throwing stuff away is it feels horrible when you're doing it, but sometimes you just have to do it and then forget about it if you can, or put it in another document where you put your throwaways, and maybe you can leave, you know, bring a little bit of it back just to, you know, even just a nugget of it. And there's been a lot of that. There's probably a couple places in here where I could have done that. There are a couple of things I repeated. I said in the middle, and then I, you know, regurgitated at the end, but I did that because I thought it was important, so I kept it. But it's, yeah, doing that is tough. But the other stuff that that I find difficult is just the sort of, like, you know, getting someone from point A to point B, which is, like, just a little tedious. You know, like most people, I want to get to the action. And so there, and then on some days it's completely different. You know how when you're working out, you always have, there's always one exercise that's not your favorite? Well, it varies, but sometimes that's the case. Yeah, I think really the toughest part and the least enjoyable part is the initial outline, though. Just having to go through structure. I mean, there are lots of books out there will give you page counts on, like, when stuff should happen and when you should move on. And I kind of follow that. And then I kind of, once you get into it, you know, sometimes those boundaries have to be stretched. Either expanded or contracted, depending on what you're going to do. I mean, if you look at a James Bond movie, except for the first 10 minutes, it's usually all Act 3. It's like, yeah. James, this thing is missing. You've got to go get it and bring it back. And that's pretty much the whole movie. I like structure. I'm kind of terrible without it. But on the other hand, you have to make this your own in some way and follow the structure as best you can.
Setting. Now, do you write setting like a character? Do you make it real, like you're writing the location where they're at, like it was something that people can feel?
Absolutely. And I all these locations I know intimately. So the Lower East Side of Vancouver, which is basically Skid Row here, I used to have an office there because it was the only one my little theater company could afford. It was like $135 a month or something like that. You had to be careful leaving if it was late at night. From the window, you could see the crack pipes glowing in the park. There were bullet holes in the bathroom window. And you know, I drank at a few of the bars occasionally just to sort of get a feel for it. So I get it. I don't know if, Al, you're ever familiar with the American Hotel or...
I lived there for a while.
Oh, did you really?
No.
No. They do have apartments above it. But I think it's a swanky place now, I think.
Oh, high end now. No, I stayed away from that part as much as I could.
But I could never figure out why the beer was so cheap until I realized that we're getting the reject kegs. Breweries. It's like, okay, I got it. The North Shore of Vancouver, which used to be an old warehouse, they used to build ships there from the turn of, like, early 1900s or late 1800s, they started building ships there. Beautiful old setting. They shot 100 movies there at least. I shot there when I shot the indie film version of this too. So I know that there are old nails that are sticking up out of boards. I know what it smells like. And I didn't make it to Vietnam, but I did do a lot of trekking in northern Thailand. So I have a sense of what that jungle actually looks and feels like. And, so I did the tactile research on this as well.
So what's next for you? What's happening now? Are you working on another book, or are you going back to acting, or what's going to go on with Barry?
The acting's a little slow yet. The sort of, you know, ramp up from the strike last summer is not really, you know, it's not up to full speed. I'm going to write a show bible for this book and start pitching it as a limited series. And then I'm moving on to Kick's next adventure, which will be taking him through Paris that I visited last summer, and down through a trip that I actually took myself in the 80s across North Africa into the Middle East, which was a little wild at times. And so I'm going to give them basically the same cover story that I had as a backpacker. And some of his cast of characters are going to join him again. And he's, you know, he's just going to be a more official CIA officer now, if he can hold himself together. And that's the next journey for David Kick Tacker, the War Machine.
So there you go, series. So now, social media, website and all that, let's give it out so people can follow you and maybe send you bad reviews and stuff.
Sure. I love your optimism. My personal website is BarryWLevy.com. There are direct links there where you can buy the book anywhere pretty much in the world. Amazon's algorithm is very pokey when it comes to populating things that you can search for. It's up there and it's selling, but, you know, if you put in the name of the book and my name, it will not pop up. So BarryWLevy.com is mine. You can get all my social links there as well. If you're looking to purchase the book, bookshop.org, you can pick, they will mail it to you, but you can pick your favorite local bookstore that will get credit for the sale, even though it may not even be in that local bookstore. I love that. Barnes & Noble, the United States, indigo.ca in Canada. And like I said, anywhere else you want to buy it, BarryWLevy.com. If they're selling it, there's a link on my webpage.
Fantastic. Of course, well, we'll put all that up on our website, too, so people have it and you can go to that, you know, stuff like that. But, you know, the biggest thing I still want to know is, you know, what was it like to work on Christmas at Dollywood?
Christmas at Dollywood. Well, yeah, I worked with the Super Cooper, Danica McKellar. It was pretty fun. It was weird because I had a beard, which I don't usually have, but someone asked me to grow it for something else, and then, you know, I had to keep it, and so then that's, I don't know if I got it because of the beard. I did not meet Dolly Parton, though,
oh,
which I'm very disappointed about, since I was technically running Dollywood. That was my role in the movie, but it was great to meet Danica, and everyone else in the movie, and it was a load of fun. My parents were thrilled with that one. I mean, their favorite moments are not like the X-Files or anything like that. My mom's favorite moment is the Bold and the Beautiful. I had like three lines on that one. She said, "Oh my goodness!" She called all her friends. Yep. So, Christmas at Dollywood was a lot of fun.
Oh, that's too bad you didn't get to meet Dolly.
I know.
Man.
I used her vaccine. We put money into the Moderna one, I think.
Moderna. That's what my mom used to call Madonna. No,
There you go. There's a good conspiracy theory in the brewing.
There you go. It's the world of conspiracy. Well, we appreciate you being here. And
I appreciate you having me.
Now, the book is called The War Machine. Don't miss it. And it's Barry W. Levy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian.
This has been a production of the House of Mystery Radio Show. To find out more about our show, guests, or hosts, go to our website at houseofmysteryradio.com.